It's the kind of story, the kind of headline that catches your eye. A statement signed by 86 evangelical leaders supporting a major initiative to fight global warming. Is that the real story? What about those who did not sign? The issue of global warming is obviously a contentious one. And I wonder, what do evangelical leaders, what business do they have talking about global warming as evangelical leaders? We're going to talk about that issue here for the next 25 minutes of Issues Etc. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Kyle Beisner is going to join us here in just a moment, and we'll cover that. And then we're going to hear a little piece from CNN. They had an interview with the cartoon editor of the Danish newspaper that published that cartoon that started those riots. And he's not backing down. We'll find out whether Dr. Alvin Schmidt is surprised by the reaction to those cartoons depicting Muhammad as a terrorist in the next 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Cal Beisner is Associate Professor of Historical Theology at Knox Theological Seminary in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He's author of the book, Where Garden Meets Wilderness, Evangelical Entry into the Environmental Debate. Dr. Beisner, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's good to be back with you.
What's the real story here? I mean, the headline is that 86 evangelical leaders supported this initiative to fight global warming. What about those who didn't sign?
Well, there are lots of real stories here. It's a rather interesting mix. I'd say, you know, one thing that I'd like to do first is just to make sure that we're being peaceable here. We probably have, at the Interfaith Stewardship Alliance, a whole lot more areas of agreement with the folks who issued this statement today than we have areas of disagreement. And unfortunately, the secular media really are trying to turn this into a matter of, you know, evangelicals fighting with each other. That shouldn't be the case. but the Evangelical Climate Initiative, which is just newly formed and held its first press conference today and released this this statement calling for the Bush administration to embrace mandatory carbon dioxide emission reduction policies to prevent or reduce global warming. The group it does not represent a consensus of evangelicals, and in fact, the Interfaith Stewardship Alliance, in communication with the National Association of Evangelicals, which really is the organization that would be closest to being able to speak for a consensus of evangelicals, recently came to agreement with NAE that there is not a consensus on this among evangelicals, and that's why NAE declined to endorse any such statement as an organization. So whereas you have some 85-plus people who've signed this statement, I think actually the bigger news story is that the NAE, which represents some 30 to 40 million evangelicals in its various member denominations and organizations, agreed that there is not a consensus on this, and that therefore we ought not to be speaking as if there is.
What's the real issue here? I mean, people hear the term global warming, and they think either kind of radical environmentalism, or they think in more mundane, kind of close-to-home terms, am I ruining the world for my children by getting in my car yet one more time? What's the real issue here from your perspective?
Well, the real issue, frankly, and it doesn't sound real exciting, the real issue is that different people read the empirical evidence and the economic evidence in different ways. In terms of fundamental worldview and theological commitments and basic ethical commitments and driving motivations, we at the Interfaith Stewardship Alliance, who would oppose the kind of statement that the Evangelical Climate Initiative has come out with, have basically the same views that they have. We share their motivation that says, you know, we're concerned about the impact of this stuff, especially on the poor people of this world. They think that the science and the economics tell us that global warming is not only real, but also it's going to be catastrophic in its effects, and that those effects will be primarily most heavily on the poor of the world. We We think that the scientific evidence indicates, on the contrary, that global warming will not be catastrophic, that it will be quite moderate. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, its projections of warming have fallen consistently over about the last 15 years and now generally range in the 1 to 2.5 degree range, Fahrenheit, over this coming century. That's roughly in agreement with where most of the critics of the global warming catastrophism notion have said. We think that instead the greater danger to the poor comes from the embrace of the very policies that this statement endorses as a way of fighting global warming. We think that if we require mandated carbon emissions reductions, we will drive up energy prices, and since energy is a crucial component in the production of practically everything, that means we'll drive up all sorts of other prices. And since the poor spend the vast majority of their income on food, clothing, pure water, if they can get it at all, and shelter, a general rise in any prices, even if it's a small rise, can put many of them over the edge from subsistence to starvation or death. And we also think that that we have good reason to think that it is much cheaper to adapt to a changing environment than it is to prevent changes in environment, and that therefore if we spend a whole lot of money trying to prevent global warming, and it probably will not work, which even the IPCC says is the case, if we spend all that money trying to prevent it, that money is not available to spend on adapting to it. And we think that the adaptation response is the much better response.
So your basic concern about the statement signed by the evangelical leader supporting this initiative to fight global warming is the law of unintended consequences. They intend good, but the policies set forth there, which they support by their signatures, may in fact do more harm than good in the long run. Am I fairly characterizing this?
That's quite fair. The last thing that we would do would be to question the motivation of the folks behind this. I think, you know, they are to be commended for their concern for the poor. We disagree with them as to what is the best way to express and to facilitate that concern. We have explained why in a paper called an examination of the scientific, ethical, and theological implications of climate change policy, which your listeners could read easily online at our website, www.interfaithstewardship.org.
Could you summarize the basics of that statement?
It's about a 50 or 60 page paper, but the first part is on science. It's by Dr. Roy Spencer, who is a climatologist and research scientist at the University of Alabama, formerly with NASA, who's been writing on global climate change for about 15 or 20 years. He is recognized as one of the world's leading experts in the field. And he reviews the various data, reviews the state of the art of the science in this, and concludes that that the most likely range of temperature increase over the next century is probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 3/4 of a degree to 1.5 or 2 degrees Fahrenheit, and that will not bring on any kind of catastrophic conditions, and that even if we were able to achieve the carbon emission reductions goals of the Kyoto Accords, the actual reduction in warming that would be achieved by that would be probably less than a tenth of a degree. And that would come at a cost, according to the Swedish economist Bjorn Lomborg, Swedish environmentalist Bjorn Lomborg, who wrote the book The Skeptical Environmentalist, probably somewhere near $1 trillion a year to the world economy. That money could instead be spent on all sorts of things, like providing clean drinking water, which would immediately be saving millions of lives, rather than theoretically sparing some lives from global warming.
We should point out, just as an aside here, and I think it's important, though, to point out that it is waterborne illness and the lack of clean drinking water that accounts for the vast majority of disease deaths in the third world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right now, for lack of safe drinking water supplies, something in the neighborhood of 2 to 4 million deaths per year occur. Of those, a majority are of children. These are highly premature deaths, and they are very preventable at a fraction of the cost of preventing global warming. We also argue in the ethics section of the paper, done by Paul Dreesen, who is with the Congress on Racial Equality, that the mandatory reductions in carbon emissions will fall most heavily upon the poor because of the impact of rising energy prices on prices generally. And then my own portion is on the theological implications, which combines both theological and ethical discussion, but ends with an analysis of risk assessment and risk response models, and argues that the best response is not to something like this, is not prevention, but adaptation, that it is the most likely to do the most good.
A couple other details here, Dr. Beissner. The man-made issue. I mean, my perception, and this is a casual observation, and so but it's simply a perception, is that most people are willing to concede that some climate change is taking place.
That is absolutely clear, and it has been the case for all of Earth history.
Climate changes. It's kind of the definition of climate.
Yes.
But the real bone of contention is it man-made? Are we responsible?
Right.
That is a question.
That is the point of debate, or one of the points of debate. And in my reading of the science, and I've been reading in this for about, 16 years now, I've read 6 or 7 full-length books by climatologists on global climate change. I've read a large portion of the 1995 IPCC report, which a few people do. I've kept up with updates since then. I've read hundreds of articles. I'm not a climate expert, but I'm a pretty well-educated layman on this stuff. In my understanding, the best scientific estimate is that human impact on global climate is minute, that it is such a small fraction of changing global average temperatures that whatever we could do to change it would make next to no significant impact on actual future climate.
So whether it was global warming or any other issue that we're talking about here, what we're really, the real nub of the issue is, look, if we are going to act in concert, set policy and act accordingly over a long period of time in response to what we perceive to be a problem, if we're going to do that, let's do it in such a judicious way that we do the least amount of harm in trying to fix, not necessarily fix, but deal with the problem.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. You know, in one element of the Hippocratic Oath is first do no harm. And we think that at this point anyway, the science does not adequately support a call for urgent or mandatory carbon emissions reductions. There are all sorts of good incentives for why all of us would want to reduce our carbon emissions anyway, because all of those are, you know, come from our burning up of energy. And frankly, that's costly to us. So we have a natural incentive anyway in minimizing our costs to do that. But what is the best balance of how to do that versus other things is something that, frankly, is still very much something we need to make decisions on as individuals and communities, and not, I think, something that ought to be treated by international treaties or even by national policy so much.
You know, I've thought about this quite a bit, and I have struggled with it because I'm unsure of the science. I just, you know, not educated enough to be able to form a decent opinion on the science. I hear the rhetoric on both sides of this. I ask myself, as a Christian, why should I care? The only plausible answer, and I think it's a rather solid answer, is that if there is, if this problem does exist, my first concern ought to be for my neighbor.
Right.
And I have an obligation as a Christian, according to my vocation, to love my neighbor and to seek to protect him and help him in every circumstance, especially in his need. And this is something that presents a need. What do you think?
Yes, I think that is absolutely right. And particularly, we need to be looking after the least of these. We need to look after the people who are the most vulnerable. Now, the Evangelical Climate Initiative folks will say, look, that's what we're trying to do, because we think that if global warming really does happen, and it is catastrophic, it is going to hit those people the hardest. Sea level increases will flood low-lying areas of the world, and in many of those areas, the population is overwhelmingly poor, such as the coastal regions of Bangladesh, as an example. Now, as a motivation, I applaud them there. My problem is that I don't think that the science adequately supports what they're claiming. And further, I think that that economic history tells us that we would be far better able to prevent the flooding of those areas, even if the sea level increase happens, that is projected. We would far better prevent that flooding of those areas by adaptation, the building of dikes and the like, at far lower cost than by trying to prevent the sea level increase, which is only debatably connected with global warming anyway, has been going on for a couple of centuries, and is probably not stoppable anyhow. So in that case, if we spend $50 trillion over the next 50 years trying to prevent global warming, and the sea level increase occurs anyway, we don't have that $50 trillion available to build dikes.
We're talking about a statement signed by 86 evangelical leaders supporting a major initiative to fight global warming. Dr. Cal Beisner is our guest, Associate Professor of Historical Theology at Knox Theological Seminary in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and he's author of the book Where Garden Meets Wilderness, Evangelical Entry into the Environmental Debate. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, and our call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In about 10 minutes, we'll talk with Dr. Alvin Schmidt about the Muslim riots over a Danish cartoon. That's coming up here in about 10 minutes. Dr. Beisner, how do you respond? I mean, what you find in this debate, in society in general, intra-Christian conversation, but what you find in this debate in the culture is more often these are the voices represented. The true believers, when it comes to the science of global warming, usually in the case of it's a disaster that's about to happen, mm-hmm. or those who doubt entirely everything and dismiss it as nonsense and simply say, global warming, global schmorming, and they don't want to deal with it at all.
You know, Todd, I find a lot of folks in the first category that you just suggested, but I'm not aware of, I mean, I certainly would not be able to name anybody in the second category. I suppose there must be some such people. There are still flat earthers among us. But I'm not aware of anybody who denies that global climate change is happening and that recently it has been in the upward direction rather than in the downward direction. What some scientists are arguing is that the popular conception of the magnitude of human contribution to it is far beyond what the scientific data would support, and that the expectation of catastrophe is not adequately supported by the scientific data. And I think that's a very defensible point of view. In fact, whereas most people seem to think that there is a general agreement among climate scientists that global warming is going to be quite large in magnitude, what's actually happened is that the consensus, insofar as there is one, and there's very little consensus, has been trending downward rather than trending upward over the last 15 to 20 years as climate models and data collection have become increasingly sophisticated and reliable. I would venture that it's it's likely that among professional climatologists, meteorologists, atmospheric physicists, atmospheric chemists, there is no consensus that global warming is going to be catastrophic, and that there's probably a majority that would say that it is not going to be.
Here's my basic concern. I mean, regardless of who falls where on the whole issue, my basic concern is, as a Christian, and perhaps you can address it, is that if influential, prominent evangelical leaders on either side of this issue, they go and they meet with the senators and they talk policy, mm-hmm. can they avoid lending the evangelical credential to something where they really can't say, thus saith the Lord, on a certain issue?
Yeah.
Do they run the risk of giving the people the impression that if you're really a Christian, really concerned about your neighbor, you will follow policy X or policy Y?
Yeah, I think they do run that risk. And I did read the statement issued by the Evangelical Climate Initiative, and I believe that it does run that risk in a pretty big way, and I'm saddened by that. But let me hasten to say first, we are a society committed to the principle of government by the consent of the governed. And there is no way for our elected representatives to know what the governed think unless the governed try to communicate to them. So I have no objection whatsoever to the people involved in the ECI having stated their convictions about this. I may disagree with their conclusions, and I hope to be able to work with some friends on this who are well qualified to put together some sort of a response to it. But I am not upset about their basically going out and expressing their opinion on this. I would have had a big problem if something like the National Association of Evangelicals had issued such a statement, because the NAE purports to speak as the consensus voice of the, you know, millions of members of its member denominations, and that consensus simply doesn't exist. But for individuals, including well-known evangelical leaders, to express their individual concerns on this, I think is perfectly legitimate, and I don't object to it at all. I do have problems with saying, if you don't agree with us, you are denying the Lord somehow. That, I think, is quite a stretch. And it illegitimately imports moral authority of Scripture into something that, frankly, is still much too debatable.
Dr. Cal Beisner is Associate Professor of Historical Theology at Knox Theological Seminary in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, author of the book Where Garden Meets Wilderness, Evangelical Entry into the Environmental Debate. And I understand, Dr. Beisner, that you are Gretchen Passantino, well, at one time Passantino's brother-in-law.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
It's a small, small world.
I taught her everything she knows.
Ah, that's good. Well, I tell you what, that's saying something, because she knows quite a bit. She's a regular guest on this program and a good friend.
She, of course, will say that she taught me everything I know.
That could be equally true. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd. God bless you.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Among the most difficult books of the Old Testament is that of the prophet Ezekiel. Yes, Ezekiel's visions and oracles are difficult to understand, yet their message is nothing else than Scripture's message, the message of law and gospel, sin and grace, death and new life. Can the book of Ezekiel be read in a Christ-centered, cross-focused way? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for February is the Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel chapters 1 through 20. This book is $42.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, visit our website, issuesetc.org. Look for the Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel. Or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, their number 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues, Etc. book of the month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel, chapters 1 through 20.
Noah's Flood. It was the second greatest catastrophe.
Answers with Ken Ham, an international speaker and author with the Answers in Genesis Ministry. Well, Ken, you're actually saying there was a bigger catastrophe than the flood of Noah's day. That was an event that covered the entire world with water and wiped out every living thing that moved on the earth.
Well, Mark, as hard as it may seem to imagine, there was another tragic event in history even bigger than Noah's flood. In fact, this one event became the saddest day in the history of the universe. And even though it happened about 6,000 years ago, we can still feel the effects of this tragic event every day. You see, our world was once perfect. No death, no suffering, no disease. But all these things became part of everyday life when the very first man, Adam, chose to disobey God by eating the forbidden fruit. Before sin, God held everything together perfectly. But because of sin and the curse, God withdrew some of that sustaining power. We now have a world that's running down, a world full of death and suffering. We see destructive hurricanes and tidal waves, horrible diseases. Yes, the day Adam sinned was the saddest day in the history of the universe, and that's why all people are sinners. But the day Jesus rose from the dead, that was the greatest day, because we can be saved from our sin.
What about Adam's son Cain? Where did he find his wife? It's one of the most asked questions we receive at the Answers Ministry. Ken Ham provides the answer in his free booklet, available on our website, AnswersRadio.com. AnswersRadio.com.
Dr. Peter Scare on how Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, is unique.
We take seriously the words of our Lord, you know, that we are to be called to be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. We are faithful to the Scriptures, and we are faithful to word and sacrament. We are both evangelical and Catholic. We are evangelical in that we believe the Word of God to be true, that we believe the Bible, and we're not going to back down from it. At the same time, we're Catholic. We recognize that this church has been around for 2,000 years. We also recognize that God is continuing to work through means, that He's working through the water of baptism, that He's working through the body and blood of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. So we take seriously our mission to be a light and salt to the earth.
For more information on Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, go to their website, ctsfw.edu, or call them at 1-800-481-2155.
On the next Focus on the Family, the founder of Prison Fellowship, Chuck Colson, joins Dr. James Dobson to discuss what it means to live the good life. In a conversation that talks about what motivates him, Colson reveals the importance of his calling, his gratitude to what God has done in his life, and the mandate to fight for what we believe. All on the next Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Oh, this is just funny. Watching Jeff try and deal with technical issues, especially when they deal with the computer, is just like a comedy of errors. I'm tempted to say, let's hire a chimp to do this one. All you have to do is press a mouse button. That's all you got to do. I mean, this is Mr. Sports, and his hand-eye coordination seems to be lacking at this point. He can shoot a basketball and tell others how, but he cannot seem to get this crazy computer to do what he wants it to do. We're going to talk about these cartoons. Not on the lighter side. You know, you'd think if you're going to talk about cartoons, you'd do something that was funny. These are not funny. They're not intended to be funny. They're intended to be social and political commentary. One of them depicting Muhammad. That's strike number one. Then depicting Muhammad with the bomb in his turban was published in a Danish cartoon. And the Danish newspaper, the Jyllands Posten, I think is how it's pronounced, published the cartoon. And the next thing you knew, well, actually not the next thing you knew, the next thing people knew about the cartoons, there were riots, there were embassies burning. And, of course, that's the stuff of yesterday and today's news. We're going to talk about these riots. First, we're going to hear from a CNN piece, an interview with Fleming Rose, who's the culture editor for Jyllands Posten, and he's going to talk about whether or not he has any regrets for allowing the cartoon to be printed. Then, Dr. Alvin Schmidt will join us for his thoughts on this. My first question for him is going to be, are you at all surprised at the reaction to the cartoons in the Islamic world? This is Zane Vergy of CNN. Interviewing Fleming Rose, the culture editor for this Danish newspaper.
Do you regret your decision? No, I mean, I do not regret it. And I think it is like asking a rape victim if she regrets wearing a short skirt at the discotheque Friday night. In the sense that in our culture, if you are wearing a short skirt, that does not necessarily mean that you invite everybody to have sex with you. As is the case with these cartoons, if you make a cartoon, make fun of religion, make fun of religious figures, that does not imply that you humiliate or denigrate or marginalize a religion. If I could just finish my point. In fact, I brought two cartoons to make my point. If you look at this one, this is the David Starr attached to the bomb, and it's made by the same cartoonist who did the cartoon with the prophet with a bomb in his turban. And the same cartoonist also made this cartoon. And these cartoons might also be offensive to Christians and Jews, but I'm just trying to make the point that we do not explicitly point out the Muslims in order to offend them. This is the way we do things in Denmark.
There are questions, though, over whether this has been a responsible decision and the issues being raised by media critics, by other Muslim groups, not only in the Arab and Muslim world, but in the United States as well, is that it was irresponsible because it was published at a time where there are rising tensions in Denmark between immigrant and non-immigrant communities, and it was unnecessarily provocative, that it didn't consider the interests and the expectations of the audience as a whole, and there was no intrinsic news value. How do you respond to those allegations and criticisms?
I mean, there was a news value. We had 5-6 cases in Denmark in the course of 2 weeks, all speaking to the problem of self-censorship and freedom of speech in terms of dealing and covering Islam. People who did not want to appear under their own name, pieces of art that were removed, imams calling on the Danish government to interfere with the press, and things like that. So, you know, there was a story out there, and we had to cover it, and we just chose to cover it in a different way. According to the principle, don't tell it, show it. And I would like to say here to your viewers that, you know, even though we have a tense discussion in Denmark about these things, there has been no anti-Muslim riots. Not a single Muslim that I know of have left the country because of these cartoons. It's the other way around. We have never had so many Muslims participating in public debates in Denmark on the pages of my newspaper, on television, on radio shows. So I think we, in fact, have had a very good and constructive debate about this.
The British newspaper The Guardian reported on Monday that 3 years ago, back in April of 2003, your paper actually refused to run cartoons that essentially poked fun at Jesus Christ and the resurrection, and that they were turned down on the grounds that they would be offensive to readers. Is that true?
It was not under my watch, and it was like a freelancer.
But it was turned down.
We did not solicit that cartoon we published approximately around the same time. Do you think that would be offensive to some Christians?
Well, that's a question to be debated, but the question The Guardian is raising is about an issue of double standards. I have one final question for you, Fleming Rose. Iran is going to hold a competition Holocaust, okay, to see whether the West will uphold the principles of free speech to the same standard as the Nazi genocide, as it did to the Prophet Muhammad. And they're saying that they're holding this contest in a direct response to your decision at your paper. I'd like to know your thoughts on that.
I can tell you that my newspaper is trying to establish a contact to that Iranian newspaper, and we would run these cartoons the same day as they will publish them. And I would like to make the point that every freelancer who show up in an editor's office does not have the right to have his things published. You know, there's a fundamental difference between the story you were referring to and my choice as an editor to approach a news story that is already out there.
All right, we should explain in the course of that interview, Fleming Rose was holding up several cartoons, one that depicted a Star of David on a bomb, and another that, it was hard to tell from the video, that depicted Jesus Christ in some sort of a political situation. And so he was trying to make his point. People shouldn't be reacting this way, and he has no regrets. Dr. Alvin Schmidt joins us to give his thoughts on the Muslim riots over this Danish cartoon. Dr. Schmidt is a regular guest. He's Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College and author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. Dr. Schmidt, welcome back.
Thank you for having me again.
Were you surprised at the reaction, the public, the violent reaction that eventually came about after the publishing of these cartoons?
No, not really. I was a little bit surprised maybe that it didn't happen earlier, because as you know, these cartoons surfaced last fall already. And, well, maybe I'm a little bit surprised in another way that the riots took place, first of all, in the Middle East rather than in Europe, in Denmark, where they really were used to agitate and excite the crowds, and even used some false cartoons, for example. I think it's probably known by now that initially the report said that Muhammad was depicted with a pig snout. Well, that was never directed at Muhammad. That was part of a cartoon in the French hog calling contest. And it was dragged in, apparently deliberately, by some Islamist who wanted to agitate the crowds and was very successful in doing so.
All right. Let's talk about the locus of the initial demonstrations and the riots that took place and why you think it was sparked first in the Middle East rather than more proximate to where, I mean, who's reading Danish newspapers in Lebanon? No one. But the Muslims in Western Europe seem to have no problem, perhaps wouldn't have had a problem had not the riots been fomented elsewhere.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because in the reason they probably flared up in the Middle East is because there they get essentially state or governmental support to doing so. For example, in Syria, you can't demonstrate on the streets without the government at least giving you tacit permission to do so. And in Europe, of course, perhaps the Muslims that are there are perhaps a little bit more open-minded, even though many are not, to the Western way of life, where we, for example, publish things that are often not very favorable even to Christianity. I mean, these people should remember the things that the newspapers and even artists have done in recent years relative to Jesus Christ. A few years ago in this country, there was the picture called, pardon the expression, but that was the name of it, Piss Christ, where the cross of Jesus Christ was crucifixed, was submerged in a container of human urine, and it was displayed in a number of art galleries and museums. Then we also had, not so long ago, The Last Temptation of Christ, a film that many Christians protested. Some of them had lined up in front of theaters, but nobody of the Christians who were protesting had ever confronted anybody physically and the like. So Christians, why they may not have liked what has happened relative to how Jesus Christ is often depicted, at the same time did not use these Islamic tactics of violence and the like. And that, I think, makes, again, a point of there's a tremendous difference between Western culture and the Middle East Islamically influenced cultures. So I think we need to recognize this. Also, for example, the many negative cartoons that are presently and have for some time been found, for example, in depicting Israel, Aaron Sharon. Remember seeing one here some time ago, sitting on sort of a cup full of blood and pictures of that condition. I have a whole file full of pictures, and then they forget that the pictures of Muhammad have been portrayed for centuries, even in the Middle East. For example, in the Topkapi Museum in Istanbul, there is a picture of Muhammad conquering Mecca. And the reason I'm bringing this up, because often the Muslims say, we may not depict any kind of picture of Muhammad. Well, that's not true. There are more than one full-face portraits of Muhammad in this particular library, also in Jerusalem. We have one, for example, in the United States in Worcester Art Museum, where Muhammad is pictured on the Barak. Barak was that mythical animal that was that had the body of a mule, the head and face of a woman, and the tail of a peacock, on which he rode in his night journey from Mecca to Jerusalem and then ascended from there to the seventh heaven. Now, that picture has been depicted in many parts of the world, and so, again, for them to say that Muhammad cannot be depicted is simply not true. In the 14th century, Persian miniature art showed Angel Gabriel speaking to Muhammad. The birth of Muhammad is depicted and shown in a picture of the 14th century in the Edinburgh University Library in Scotland. In Indonesia, a very prominent, the largest Muslim country in the world, there's a scene of Muhammad's mythical night ride again to heaven, just another example of it. And in 1928, there was a German ad that advertised bouillon extract, showed Angel Gabriel guiding Muhammad to Allah. And in the 20th century, there was a painting of Muhammad receiving a vision shown in the, and it is present in the Shriners Hall in the United States in the state of Maine. In fact, there's also one of Muhammad having his Hijra in 622 in that same building. Yet there were no riots because, well, I think these were purposely orchestrated to bring about what is going on.
Now, I found it, as I was thinking about this, I found it, if we could lay aside, and I think you've made a pretty fair case that Muslims have not uniformly forbidden the depiction of Muhammad throughout history. They've permitted it at times. Okay, so we set that aside and we say, how about this one, Dr. Schmidt? Could, let's say for the sake of argument that they'd allow, they wouldn't be offended by a mere depiction of Muhammad. There are things that Muslims believe, firmly believe Muhammad did, that are at least the that day equivalent of wearing a bomb in your turban. I mean, he was a man of great bloodshed. Would Muslims be offended by depicting Muhammad doing some of these great heroic acts they believe he did?
I don't know, but that's certainly true because the man was a very violent man. He himself said, "I am the last of the prophets and am sent with the sword." And most of Israel's, Islamic expansion was done by means of the sword. I depict that very much in my book that you're familiar with, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West, that came out a year ago, fully documented with copious examples of how Islam expanded with the sword. And in many ways, the sword is also its symbol. So Muslims apparently aren't offended when they read that or know about that, and yet I don't know how many do know it very well. But the Quran is full of violent examples, as well as in the Hadith, which is the traditions and sayings of Muhammad. So they have a major problem, I think, and I think it depicts that Muslims cannot handle, or if they cannot handle, these kinds of examples, they really do not understand or don't want to be a part of Western culture, which ironically, nevertheless, they keep coming to. 10% of France is now Islamic. And they come here in many cases, as we've often heard in the media, to have a better life, but there's more to it. There's also the idea of eventually, hopefully, I believe from what I've read about them, that they will eventually be able to take over Europe. In fact, what's his name? The retired professor at Princeton University by the name of Bernard Lewis said in the German paper Die Welt this last summer that by the end of this present century, Europe will be Islamic. I personally predict it will be there in half that time, unless the West wakes up. And even now, they're apparently capitulating to these riots, and that only gives them a stronger voice and hand and makes us weak. And behind it is our political correctness, where we're afraid to depict or, you know, even have a discussion about the matter because everybody is supposed to be sensitive to. Well, part of political process is that you have debates, and debates often aren't necessarily polite.
Do these events, the reaction to the cartoons that were published in the Danish newspaper, Do they illustrate in some way, Dr. Schmidt, the tension between the tenets of Islam as a religion and the foundational notions of Western culture, freedom of speech, and all those things, of course, borrowed from the capital of Christianity at some point?
Yes, I think they do. I think I've seen them all. I've printed them out from the internet for some moment this thing surfaced, and I have, like I said, a bulging folder full even from before that. The one, for example, was a bomb or some kind of detonation device in the hat of Muhammad, pretty much depicts the violence that Muhammad engaged in. They will not recognize this or don't want to hear the news, but it's true. It's, you know, the bomb planted in its hat, I've seen it on Fox News, for example, is an example of illustrating his violence. Even though he didn't use bombs as such, he used the sword, but it makes the point of violence. And so I think in many cases they are accurate. And maybe that is why they are rebelling as they are. But that, in other words, the truth is coming out. People don't read the Quran, but maybe this is one example of some pictures that are conveyed in a old Chinese saying, a picture is worth a thousand words. Perhaps that's another reason they're getting agitated.
Someone pointed out the irony that in reaction to depicting Muhammad, their prophet, as a violent man, they engage in violence. And I'm wondering, is there really even any irony there? Is it part and parcel of Islam?
You're right.
Violence is part of the deal.
It is. It is. It's a violent religion. And the tragedy is that we in our societies in the West, and have, whether it's in the United States or in England, we have tried to picture Islam as peace. Many of the top-ranking politicians in our country have said so. Well, it's simply not true. I often ask, why don't these people read the Quran? I, in my book, have 35 violent passages taken out of the Quran. I could have listed another 70. There are over 100 of them. Warlike, violent passages that you cannot explain away. So here is the truth. But we keep telling the people these are just, for example, a few radicals. I have not accepted the concept of radical Muslim in the first place. Because what is a radical Muslim? Is it one who believes in the Quran? Of course. And these are the people, they are really the ones who believe in the Quran and carry out the practices that have been done over the centuries. I might also mention that it's interesting that only a couple of years ago, I think it was in 2002, the audience may be interested in knowing, they may have heard of it before, but there is a Renaissance picture of Muhammad suffering physically in hell on a fresco in a in the church of what's it called, Saint it's in Bologna, in Bologna, Italy. It's Saint Petronia Church, and they tried to blow up the church because of this particular fresco hanging in that building. They were not successful. So unpleasant or depicting Muhammad in unusual ways is anything new. By the way, in the 15th century, there's a German woodcut that showed a wife scolding Muhammad as being drunken, in a drunken state. Now, again, so nothing new. In other words, 500 years ago, but it didn't bring about the results of what's happening today. And partly, I suppose, it's because of the mass media exposure. That has not helped the situation.
The Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, has been out making the rounds in the news media since the riots have been underway, and they're saying, look, we advocate neither the defamation or the lampooning of Muhammad nor the reaction that we're seeing in the Islamic world and in Western Europe. Do they really speak? I mean, many people would say, now there's the real voice of peace-loving Islam, the religion of peace. How do you react?
Well, the CARE situation has a very dubious record. In fact, it has, in many cases, supported more of the violence than it has mitigated or curtailed it. it's never really come out and made strong condemnations of all the different violent acts that have been going on since 9/11. They get a lot of publicity, and they're perhaps the most powerful organization in the United States, but they are not on the Western side of culture.
And in terms of how they represent Islam, how would you assess it, CARE?
Well, they usually present it very, very positively and depict, for example, statements that are often simply not untrue. For example, some time ago, I think, and I might have even been interviewed in your program about this, for instance, I've seen them publish the statement out of Surah 532 out of the Quran, which indicates that God or Allah in the Quran is opposed to violence. What they fail to tell us that this has been an abrogated or is an abrogated passage in the Quran. It no longer is valid. It has been abrogated or superseded by other passages that came later. No, abrogation is a doctrine taught in the Quran that if a passage contradicts another passage, the one that is the oldest one gets abrogated or annulled, and the more recent one holds sway.
30 seconds here, Dr.
And so this is an example that they have many cases. I have a number of examples in my files where they have touted this passage as Islam being a religion of peace, when in fact in the ninth chapter or Surah 9, these are contradicted, and those passages are more recent, and they overrule what was said in Surah 532.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College. He's author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. You can find that book at Amazon.com or by calling 1-800-636-2470. It's 1-800-636-2470. It's called The Great Divide by Dr. Alvin Schmidt. Dr. Schmidt, thanks for being our guest.
My pleasure.
Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, in addition to underwriting issues, etc., also offers excellent retreats, both in the fall and in the spring. Well, spring is coming. And they have several retreats. One is a confirmation retreat near the end of the month of April. It focuses on the Lord's Prayer. There's also a biblical world retreat that's coming in May. That's still spring. It's focusing on Christ in the Old Testament. The leader of that retreat will be none other than a regular guest here on this program, Dr. John Seleska. They all take place at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. You can find out more about them. Give them a call. Area code 260-452-2247, 260-452-2247, or at our website, issuesetc.org. Tomorrow on the program, Bob Leko will join us. We'll talk about God's view of false teachers and their teachings. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.